Afternoon, brethren. The privilege to be here with you. Take a second here to get this thing set up to where we can hopefully see a couple of maps. We truly live in a wired world. I'm amazed at the announcements and the tone of the announcements that we're pushing so much more information out to the internet or to the web and trying to connect people, to different sites and things like that by accessing our information, distributing our information via the web. It's amazing. Don't have a lot of slides here. I only have about four, and I want to use the maps as just a little bit of a highlight. Again, I'd like to welcome all, any guests and visitors that we have here with us today, and also the cyber visitors, if the internet connection is working okay. I'd like to thank the Flynn extended family for the beautifully done special music. That was beautifully done. This year at the Passover, as is customary with, I believe, every Passover that I have observed, we typically start in John 13, and we will read or we're guided through passages from John 13, and generally the conclusion is in the first few verses of John 18, and then we are left on our own after the service or in preparation for the Passover service to read verses about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ and his resurrection, the events that took place, after John 18. This year, I was struck in reading in the Gospel of John about the events that lead up to John 13, and then also the events in John 19 and 20. The thing that struck me this year was how much that in John 13 to 18 that men are focused on and that men are highlighted. You know, the dialogue is specifically and the discussion is about Jesus Christ, his interaction with the disciples, how he is arrested, and all of the things that take place, leading up to the crucifixion, his 3 days and three nights in the grave, and his resurrection. But this year, I was struck on both sides of that section of Scripture as to how much that women are highlighted in the passages prior to John 13 and also after John 18. And that's really my purpose this afternoon, the time that I have, is to focus specifically on three very special women and how they interacted with Jesus Christ. I will be quoting from a book written by Herbert Lockyer, who was a scholar born in the late 1800s and lived up until at least the mid-1950s and perhaps later than that. I haven't been able to determine that. And he wrote a book that I have quoted from or will quote from quite a bit called All the Women of the Bible. And he has a treatment of basically every woman's name and all of the women that are not listed by name, in the Bible. First of all, I'd like to get oriented geographically and chronologically. So if you would, we're very familiar with starting with John 13. If you just turn back a page, or at least in my Bible, and we look at the first verse in John 12, then what we see here is chronologically, this is 6 days before the Passover. Then Jesus comes to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. So the events that we're gonna go through are very close to, the first New Testament Passover. Here we have, this specific, time frame listed here, 6 days before the Passover, and this is one of the events that we're going to focus on. Now then, if we turn back to John, the 10th chapter, and let's take a look at verse 22 and just mention these in passing. These are not really all that big of a thing, but just to fix us chronologically and geologically. Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, it was winter. So we know that Feast of Dedication, depending on how the calendars line up, is typically, early December. So from December of that year up until, the Passover is the time frame that these events that we're going to discuss took place. And they took place in a place when we start here. Let's jump back over to John 10 and down in verse 40. And this is speaking of Jesus Christ, and this is going to be the introduction to the first story. And he, Jesus Christ, went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was baptizing at first, and there he stayed. And then many came to him and so forth. But so it says Jesus Christ wasn't at this location here. He wasn't at Bethany. He was somewhere across the Jordan River, and it's also known as Bethany across the Jordan. Bethany across the Jordan in another place is called Beth Abra. And I've got a couple of little maps up here, and basically from a macroscopic to microscopic view, here's the eastern Mediterranean. We see the land of Israel, and we see, if I'm not sure how that cursor is going to show up. Yeah, it does. Good. We see the Sea of Galilee up here. Jerusalem is down in this area right there. We see over here, we see Nazareth, Jesus Christ's birthplace. Let's go down to our next map here. It's a little bit clearer to read. We focus on, and those Romans, they put their names on everything. So this lake right here, the Sea of Galilee, is also known as Lake Tiberias, after one of the Romans. One observation about the Sea of Galilee is it's not very big. And for those of you in the big sandy area, if I did my arithmetic anywhere close to correctly, if we look at the triangle that is described from Gilmer to Gladewater to Big Sandy, the Sea of Galilee would fit pretty well in that triangle in terms of, you know, the dimensions. You know, it obviously is a different shape than the triangle of Gilmer to Gladewater to Big Sandy. But that's roughly the geographic size of the area in which many of the events that we're going to read today took place. So this area right here is essentially would fit in, you know, in the area that we know very well in, you know, Gilmer, Gladewater, Big Sandy. Okay, let's start in John chapter 11 and verse 1. And we're going to highlight two very special sisters here in this passage. This is about the death of Lazarus. Now, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany. This is a different Bethany. So if we go to this larger map that I have here, we'll see that the Sea of Galilee is right here. Here's Bethsaida, where many of the disciples were called. We see right over here, here's Cana, which is in John 4, was the wedding where Jesus Christ did his first miracle. We see some of these other little cities around, these little villages around this area. From the Sea of Galilee down here toward Jerusalem, it's somewhere on the order of 60 to 80 miles. Don't know exactly what that is, but it's on the order of 60 to 80 miles. And so we see Jerusalem right here. So roughly, for our geography, that's about from here to Terrell. Roughly. So we're looking at that kind of distance. So when we read about passages of, you know, this individual traveled from this village to you know, this area, that hopefully will orient us geographically a little bit. But Bethany is a couple of miles, it's 2 miles east of Jerusalem. And you can see if the cursor shows up halfway decently there, that's the Bethany that we're talking about here in John 11. The Bethany across the Jordan, there's a number of different opinions by scholars on that. Some say that it was the ford over here by where Jericho is. Others say that it was way up here closer to the Sea of Galilee. I'm not sure. But the point is, Jesus Christ wasn't at this Bethany. Was not at this Bethany when that we're going to read about. And Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. So we're first introduced to these two ladies. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil, wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So we see there's a family there. Got two sisters and a brother. Therefore the sisters sent to him, that is Jesus Christ, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Don't know how long that would have taken to have communicated from Bethany here by Jerusalem to wherever Jesus Christ was on the other side of the Jordan, whether that was just across by Jericho or if it was on up there toward the Sea of Galilee. Verse 5 is key here. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And it says it about as succinctly as you can in terms of describing the depth of the feelings that Jesus Christ had for this family. Some observations about this is, my opinion is, and this is just my opinion, I believe that that's birth order as well. Martha, and then Mary, and then Lazarus. There's no way to prove that I know of, but I believe that from some of the context, we will see that as we learn more about these ladies and how Jesus Christ interacted with them, we'll see some things about that. But I believe that Martha was the oldest and that Mary was the middle child and Lazarus was the little brother, so to speak. Verse 6, so when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Now, why would he do that? Why would he do that? Why wouldn't he just immediately leave where he was and head for Bethany? And then after this, he, Jesus Christ, said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. You'll see on this map right here, this is a description. When we see Judea, then we're talking about this area here. And we see Galilee, we're talking about this area in this region right here. So when we see Judea, we're talking about, you know, the area down here around Jerusalem and in Bethany. His disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and you're going there again? They just tried to kill us. They just tried to kill you, and we're going to go back? You know, they were incredulous at that. And Jesus answered in verse 9, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if any walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And I'm sure that they didn't have a clue as to what he was referring to at that point. And we'll see that again a little bit later. These things he said after that, he said to them, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. Verse 12. Then his disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get well. So there, we've got the physical-spiritual duality. I mean, he's talking in spiritual terms. They're comprehending physically. They're thinking, oh, he needs a good night's rest. That'll help him get over whatever ails him. But Jesus Christ is referring to something in a different plane or different level. Then Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So if we go back here and we look at the verse that I read where that he said he stayed 2 more days. I think the only conclusion that we can draw from that is Jesus Christ was waiting for Lazarus to die, for Lazarus to expire. And that illness was going to run its course, and Lazarus was going to die, and then Jesus Christ was going to arrive in Bethany, and he was going to resurrect Lazarus back to life. And I think that those passages, when we put those together, we get that sense that he knew what was going to happen. He knew when Lazarus died, and he certainly had the overarching purpose that he would be glorified by that resurrection. Verse 15. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let's go to him. And then Thomas says, let's go and we'll die too. So, you know, Thomas didn't get what was going on there. But I think that's a reference to the concern that they had about, you know, we're going to go back to a place where we just barely got out of there with our lives at some point, you know, in the past. So again, we have that physical, spiritual, contrast there between Jesus Christ and the disciples. Couple of thoughts here about Martha, and as we read some of these other passages, I'd like for us to look at Martha, you know, in this context. Martha, in my opinion, was the extrovert in the family. Martha was the practical lady in the family. I think by contrast is how we understand a lot about Martha and Mary. But I think it's interesting to note that Martha is mentioned first. And Martha is discussed first. Let's continue in 17. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. So wherever it was, it took them some time, which I think lends some credence to the point that maybe they were up there closer to the Sea of Galilee, because if we were walking here from Terrell, we wouldn't be able to do that in a single day or two. You know, it would take a number of days, you know, to traverse that kind of distance. Verse 18, now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away. And I think if you're looking in the King James, it says something like 15, 16 furlongs. For the track individuals in our midst, a furlong is 220 yards. So you basically have 8 furlongs to the mile. You know, in the New King James, then it makes it easier for us to understand, saying that distance here, when we look at the map, Jerusalem to Bethany is only a couple of miles. So that's pretty close. 19, And many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Now Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Both of those ladies dealt with grief differently. Ever how they did. Mary stayed put. Martha went to meet Jesus Christ. That very much strikes me as that she was the firstborn. She was an energetic individual. She was, she was someone that that I think was very practical. And I think some of the characteristics that Herbert Lockyer brings out says Martha was industrious, ever active, and impulsive. And Mary was more meditative and reticent. So we have that contrast. But Martha, even dealing with the death of a family member, gets up and goes out to meet Jesus Christ. Mary, on the other hand, doesn't stay there, or doesn't go. She stays there. But there's one thing about Martha and Mary and Lazarus. It is believed that Martha was an affluent woman, that Martha owned the house that they were living in. And because of the way that it mentions the house in the village, there are some that believe that that was the most prominent house in the village of Bethany, that Martha had, was a woman of independent means, that she had a warm, hospitable home that Jesus Christ was comfortable visiting. And this apparently was not the only time that Jesus Christ ever interacted with Martha and Mary. But that she had a position apparently of importance in the community of Bethany, and their home was, again, as I said, one of the chief ones in the village. I think it's also indicative of the position of the family that there were quite a number of people that came to visit Martha and Mary to console them and to comfort them in the death of their brother Lazarus. Let's continue in verse 21. Now Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died." That to me, there's an aspect of faith and conviction that she expresses right there. Lord, if you'd been here, you could have done something. He would not have died. And I think look at the dynamic here and the extroverted nature of this lady, that she is comfortable with this kind of discourse, even in her grief with Jesus Christ. And she obviously considers him her Lord. So that is not disrespectful, but she's comfortable with this kind of interaction, with this level of interaction. Again, where's Mary? Mary's still at home. We'll read here in a little bit. Mary says exactly the same thing, but in a different context. But Martha says it first here in verse 21. Continuing in verse 22. "Even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." She was a woman of faith. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Listen, look at the dialogue. Martha says to him in verse 24, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Look at the truth that she understood. That's the last great day message. That is understanding, as best she could and with what was presented to her at that time, that there was going to be life again, that there would be resurrection. So she obviously understood, some of the truth that we understand today, and that God has called us to see. But she understood about resurrection and mentioning there, that you'll raise him up at the last day. So the dialogue continues. Jesus said to her, now we go back to, Jesus Christ with the spiritual physical duality here. "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" So the dialogue continues. And in verse 27, she said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come, or who is to come into the world." When she'd said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, "The teacher has come and is calling for you." I find that interesting that Mary, or that Martha is still, the context is here, her brother's just been dead for three or four days. And she's obviously in grief, but she's thinking of her sister. And she makes that, she sends back to her sister, discreetly is the way that secretly comes across to me, and without pretense and not, you know, not in some pompous manner or whatever, but she says, you know, sends the message to her sister, the teacher has come and is calling for you. Jesus Christ wants to see you too. Verse 29, and as soon as she'd heard that, she rose quickly and came to him, and that's talking about Mary. Now Jesus had not yet come into town, but he was in the place where Martha met him. So there's somewhere outside of Bethany, Martha had already, gone to meet him and encountered him. So this wasn't at their house yet. Then the Jews who were with her in the house, and that's speaking of Mary and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, she's going to go to the tomb and weep there. And when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. She says the same exact thing that Martha did. And what's interesting, when we contrast Mary and Martha a little bit, as far as I can tell, these are the only recorded words that we have that Mary spoke. The only recorded words that Mary spoke. We've read quite a bit of dialogue, on the other hand, of Martha's interaction with Jesus Christ. But I can't find another place where words of Mary, this Mary, are recorded. One of the things to note, and almost a little bit humorously, when you read some of the passages about Jesus Christ's interaction, would you think, would any lady not name Mary please raise their hand? Because you have Mary, the mother of Jesus. You have Mary of Bethany, which is Martha of Bethany's sister. We have Mary, the wife of Cleophas. And on and on it goes. So there's some confusion about, which Mary we're talking about sometimes, and it takes a little bit of reasoning to figure out which one it applies to. But this one is Mary. She's also known as Mary of Bethany. And then Martha is distinct. She's also known as Martha of Bethany. Okay, let's continue in verse 32. Oh, that we just read that where Mary's words about, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Verse 33, therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. And it says, Jesus wept. I don't know about you, but I usually think of the other verse when it says Jesus wept, I usually think about where he's weeping over Jerusalem. But this is specifically in the context of the grief that Martha and Mary are experiencing. And I think what is fascinating to me about this is, he already has told the disciples what's going on and why it's going on. So his emotion to me in this is because of his love of Martha and Mary, that you think, now Jesus Christ, who is fixing to resurrect Lazarus from the dead here in just a few minutes, is moved in spirit enough because of his feelings for Martha and Mary that he groans in his spirit, or groans in the spirit, as it says, and was troubled, and he weeps. He wept. I think that bespeaks of the depth of his feelings for these three individuals. Verse 36, then the Jews said, see how he loved him. And some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind have also kept this man from dying? That's a logical conclusion. Continuing verse 38, and then Jesus, again, groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was the cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, take away the stone, Martha, and take away the stone. Martha, the ever practical one and outspoken one in this context, and not outspoken in a disrespectful or a wrong way, to me comes across in an extroverted way. Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there's a stench. He's been in the grave 4 days. He's been dead for 4 days. A very practical understanding of the condition that Lazarus was in. And I think speaking out of concern, not only for Jesus Christ, but for the people that were there. Verse 40, Jesus said to her, did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of these people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. And I think this is an eloquent way of saying, you know, you already know what I need, and we already know what's going to take place here, but because of the humans that were there, then there is this short discourse from Jesus Christ to the Father. Verse 43. And when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Come out of there, Lazarus. And I think there's a little bit of humor to me in 44 when he says, he who died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said, loose him and let him go. Can you imagine Lazarus tottering out of that tomb with the grave clothes wrapped about him, and probably his legs somewhat bound? So you see this kind of tottering that would have had to have taken place for him to, you'd be able to get out of that tomb. But can you imagine the joy that Martha and Mary would have experienced, you know, at that point? So we're going to leave that section there. And again, I'd like to read just some observations again from Herbert Lockyer about characteristics of Martha in this. Again, my observation is that I believe she was the firstborn, and she acts like a firstborn, an extroverted firstborn in this role. She had a warm and hospitable home at Bethany that Jesus was comfortable visiting. You know, and what's interesting to me is there's that same statement is not made about Jesus Christ's own brothers and sisters. He had a very special relationship with these three individuals that apparently transcended the relationship that he had physically with half brothers and half sisters. It's likely that Martha and Mary were affluent, and that Martha owned her own home. They occupied a position of importance in the village. There were a number of people that were there, I believe, to show their respects and out of respect to the family, to try to console the family at the time that Lazarus died. And here's a quote that I'd like to read from Herbert Lockyer. Knowing Martha as we do, we can be assured of this fact, that whenever Jesus visited Martha's home, she never had any need to apologize for untidy rooms, a neglected household, or lack of necessary provisions. To her, home responsibilities were never a drudgery. Martha loved her home and was house proud, kept it spick and span, and was ever ready to entertain her divine guests or others seeking a refuge beneath her hospitable roof. Martha is known for her hospitality. Martha was always prepared. I mean, Martha was not the type of individual that was not comfortable with unexpected guests. She was, you know, in that sense, she was in readiness. She was prepared. I want to make a couple of contrasting points about Mary, the sister of Martha, also known as Mary of Bethany, to differentiate her from the number of Marys that I mentioned earlier. Here's a quote from Herbert Lockyer. Mary also sat at Jesus' feet and was content to linger there because her disposition and inward silent brooding made it hard for her to be at home in the world of affairs. Now, that's somebody's opinion, but I think it's an interesting in reading through the different stories of seeing how very different that Martha and Mary conducted themselves. And it's said that Mary cultivated deep spiritual inner thoughts and who was busier internally than she was externally. Martha, you know, has the reputation of being busy externally, you know, that she was industrious. Mary, by contrast, is said by Herbert Lockyer to be busy internally, you know, that we have an internal and external contrast here between these two sisters. Now I'd like to go and read the second story that's going to be a part of John 12 and also four verses or so from Luke 10. Let's go back and read Luke 10, and we'll read the very succinct. I think one of the commentators says there's 98 words here that perfectly frames a description of Martha. Luke 10 and verse 38. Now it happened as they went that he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. And again, we have that. It's her home. You know, there's no record of any husband, any children, or any other, you know, family members being involved in this. Verse 39, and she had a sister called Mary. And these two accounts are only mentioned by John, by the Apostle John, and by Luke. They're not mentioned by Matthew nor Mark. Had a sister called Mary. It's interesting that Martha's mentioned first. It doesn't say Mary and Martha. And I think I've kind of grown up with the more of a focus on Mary, with Martha as being somehow lesser, the way that it's come across to me. But that's not, in reading it recently, that's not the way that it comes across to me now. Martha occupies a position of prominence. Let's read 39 again. She had a sister called Mary who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. To me, this implies that it wasn't strictly the duality of Martha is external and she's busy in the background and only Mary is involved with listening to the teachings of Jesus Christ, because it says Martha also was at the feet of Jesus Christ. So there is an engagement there too that I hadn't focused on in the past. Verse 40, but Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, Lord, don't you care that my sister's left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me. There's a number of different opinions about what those words mean. Some of them say that Martha was just distracted in putting on the meal, and she really, you know, is kind of asking for some more help. There's another point of view that says Martha was irritated that she wasn't able to be at Jesus' feet like Mary was, because we're trying to put on a meal here, and that is, can we please have some help here so that we can get the meal organized and so that I can also be at Jesus' feet? You know, there are scholars that believe that these words can, you know, can be translated that way, and that they have that meaning. Not that she's just solely focused on the physical at the expense of the spiritual. 41. Jesus answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you're worried and troubled about many things. Some commentators say that you can look at that as Martha, you're worried or you're anxious, and that they separate that from that other clause there, and troubled about many things. So it can be read, you know, it can be read in different ways. Interesting thing about this expression, Martha, Martha. There's only three places in the Bible where it is recorded that a name is used twice like this, and this is one of them. Martha, Martha. The other two are Simon, Simon, and talking about Simon Peter in Luke, for your reference, Luke 22:31, and where Jesus Christ says, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked that he could sift you like wheat. You know, it was not a reproof. It was not a rebuke. There's also the use in Acts 9 and verse 4. Saul, Saul. Those are the only three places in the Bible where that a name is used twice together like that. Martha is the only woman who is ever recorded in this fashion. Martha, Martha. It's the only time a woman's name is repeated in this fashion. I think there is an interesting point about that in terms of, to me, the context of this is that this is, as Herbert Lockyer puts it, this is an affectionate reproof. This is very different to me than the words of Jesus Christ in another place. My eye doesn't fall on right now, where he says, Simon, shut up, shut your mouth, and get behind me, Satan. You know, he is saying, be quiet and get back behind me. That was a very strong rebuke. I mean, to put it in language that we might use today, or if we saw that taking place, that was a rebuke. These words to Martha were not that strong. They were an affectionate reproof. They weren't a rebuke. The context, I think, you know, demonstrates that this was nowhere like are nothing like the words that Jesus Christ used with, you know, Simon Peter. And obviously Simon Peter was an expert, or was an extrovert too, because, you know, he would go on and on about something or other, and in that one particular passage, you know, Jesus Christ has just had enough. He says, "Be quiet, get behind me." And that's the end of it, because I'm certain that Simon did exactly what he was told. But this is not like that. "Martha, Martha." Now let's go back to John 12. One of the things about this that I find interesting, I'm not sure that this is the same dinner. I'm not sure of that. It may be. I actually went to dug out my old Harmony of the Gospels to try to see if the scholars that produced that would have the scriptures in parallel, and they're not. So I'm not sure if this is the same account or if this is a different account. But let's read some verses out of John 12. And this one's called, the title in my Bible is called "The Anointing at Bethany." And again, Bethany, a couple miles east of Jerusalem, and chronologically, 6 days before the Passover. Now, if we've got the dates correct, in 31 A.D., the Passover was on a Tuesday night. The Holy Day was on a Wednesday, or was on a Thursday, and the preparation day for that Holy Day was on Wednesday. So, depending on how you count, from Tuesday, we're talking about, you know, dinner Wednesday night the previous week, very close to the time of the Passover. "Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him." And I find that interesting, that, you know, Lazarus is not connected in the same way with putting on the dinner, with serving, in the same way that his sisters are. "Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of that oil." A little bit about that spice. "That it was worth a great sum of money." And that it could have been, some scholars think that when it said that it was worth, in verse 5 there, 300, and Judas makes that point, you know, it was worth 300, you know, pennies or 300 denarii, why wasn't this sold? There are some scholars that say that was a day's wage for a laborer at that time. So we're looking at essentially about a year, if that's accurate, we're looking at a year's wages for a laborer is what those spices possibly could have been worth. So this was not a trivial act. That was not an inexpensive spice by any means. I don't have any way of knowing if that is correct in terms of the that specific value, but it was not a trivial thing. And then Judas makes his comments about, you know, why wasn't it sold for the poor, but he was the thief. Verse 7, "But Jesus said, 'Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me you don't have always. I think that's an interesting statement. "She has kept this for the day of my burial," anticipating and knowing that I believe that Jesus Christ was going to be crucified. I think Mary understood that. Some thoughts from Herbert Lockyer's book about Mary. It said, "Bustling around a house was not native to her deep emotion. This cameo of her, let's try to sketch her as she was, and that is as an individualist." And that's Mr. Lockyer's opinion, or was his opinion, about the difference between Martha, or one of the differences about Martha and Mary. Some thoughts from some scholars. Some scholars think that Mary of Bethany was the same as Mary Magdalene. Most do not think that. We've got that challenge of, when we say Mary, which one of them are we talking about? There's also some that think that Mary of Bethany is the woman who was caught in a sin. Most do not think that that's the case. You know, characteristics of Martha or of Mary. That's cultivated deep spiritual inner thoughts busier internally than she was externally. The inner world charmed her more than it did her sister Martha. She was teachable. She's almost always associated with being at Jesus' feet. And there was a kind of a humorous comment from one of the scholars said that both Martha and Mary studied at the University of Jesus' Feet, or at the School of Jesus' Feet. I like that. I think that the points made, too, that each of the sisters dealt very differently with grief, and they did not deal with the death of Lazarus in the same way at all. And again, the only words that we have recorded from Mary are, "Lord, if you'd been here, our brother wouldn't have died." But with Martha, we have quite a bit more dialogue. And finally, about this Mary, or Mary of Bethany, she left a legacy that's recorded in Mark 14:8, and I'd like to turn and read that. Mark 14 and verse 8. And these are the words of Jesus Christ. And this actually, contextually follows on with the verses that we read earlier. But Mark 14 and verse 8. "She has done what she could. She has come beforehand to anoint my body for burial." I think that's quite a legacy. She's done what she could. She's done what she had the capability, the influence, the means to do. And I think that's something that would be a good legacy for any of us and all of us. Dr. Lockyer makes the point that about that this will be a memorial and was a memorial for Mary. The next Mary that we're going to talk about, the third woman that we'll discuss, is Mary Magdalene. And an interesting thing, what does Magdalene mean? What does Magdalene mean? And scholars look at that and say, as Jesus was from Nazareth and was known as the Nazarene, this Mary was known as the Magdalene, but from signifying that she was from the city or the village of Magdala, M-A-G-D-A-L-A. And there's some disagreement about where Magdala is among scholars. And it can be placed, if we go back to our map, there's some that think it's up here. There's some that think it's in different places. But this last map has one, and this is the group of scholars that have the point of view that Magdala, and it's kind of hard to see down here, but this is the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee. We've got Bethsaida over here. We've got Capernaum. We've got Magdala, and I think in some maps it shows up as Migdol, M-I-G-D-O-L. Not sure if that's the same or not. But it's only about 3 miles from Capernaum to Magdala. But that's the significance when we say Mary Magdalene. We're saying Mary of Magdala. That it's not a surname. It's a notation of where she was from that differentiates her from the others. What I find interesting about this is Martha and Mary of Bethany are written about prior to John 13. There's nothing recorded after John 12 about either Martha or Mary that I can discern. So the events for these two ladies, everything that we have recorded is prior to the Passover. But with Mary Magdalene, she's mentioned one other place prior to the Passover, and then most of the references that we have, the other 13 of the 14 references that we have for Mary Magdalene or Mary of Magdala, are after the Passover and take place with the crucifixion and with the resurrection. So let's go back to the one place in Luke that mentions this Mary and read that, and then we will jump forward past the Passover to the crucifixion and to the resurrection and read more about this Mary, Mary of Magdala. Okay, Luke 8, and let's read the first 3 verses. This is also going to make some points about Martha and Mary, but this is I want to focus specifically on Mary of Magdala, Mary Magdalene. 8:1. "Now it came to pass afterwards that he went through every city and village, preaching and bringing the glad tidings of the kingdom of God, and the 12 were with him." So he's got an entourage. He's got the 12 disciples with him. Verse 2. "And certain women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities," and we have a kind of an apposition here. Mary called Magdalene, out of whom had come seven demons. This is the only place that Mary Magdalene or Mary of Magdala is mentioned, prior to the Passover. A couple of other ladies mentioned there, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna. And here's the last clause that I really want to focus on. And many others who provided for him from their substance. These weren't poor women. These were not poor women. They're providing the substance, and they are, in that sense, they're fronting, I believe, from the context. They're putting up the money to support the travel and the operations that are taking place. We go back to Mary and Martha of Bethany. She owned her own home. You know, there's an indication that there was a level of affluence there that family had that enabled them to make some contributions that others were not. But that's a key clause there. And many others who provided for him from their substance. And the context of that, I believe, is the women. And it's the women. So we've covered the location of Magdala. Magdala was known as a city or a village where that there were dye works, you know, with colors, and that there were some textile factories there. There's some interesting background, or at least to me, about Mary of Magdala. There's no record of Mary's parentage, of her marital status, or of her age. It appears that she had no home obligations or any reason that she had to stay in one place, and that she had the means to be able to travel. She was free to follow Jesus Christ, you know, in that sense. It may be that then some speculate that she was connected with that textile industry, and that, you know, was because of that had the financial means to be able to travel and to basically do what she wanted to. Mary of Magdala, by inference, has an unsavory reputation, and this is very hotly disputed. Some scholars think that she was a Reformed prostitute. I don't think that there is any scriptural evidence to prove that, and I think the scholars that draw that conclusion do so by inference, not by having, you know, specific relevant information. And here's how that is inferred. The Jewish Talmud affirms that Magdala had an unsavory reputation and that was destroyed because of the harlotry that was practiced there. And again, that's by inference. You know, we could say that about, you know, residents or citizens of any particular, you know, municipality are not necessarily, doing all of the things, good or bad, of the populace in that municipality. And I believe that so it is with Mary of Magdala. There was a comment made that the Catholic Church is responsible for some of this reputation when it established the first so-called Magdalene House in Naples in 1324 for the rescue and care of Reformed prostitutes. And so the Catholic Church is somewhat responsible for this reputation that perhaps Mary of Magdala was a Reformed prostitute. I don't know that there's any scriptural evidence to support that. The name Mary Magdalene is mentioned 14 times in the Bible. 8 times she's listed in connection with other women, and every time in those 8, she is mentioned as the head of the group. She is the leader of the women in that role of service. 5 times her name is mentioned alone, and it is always mentioned, when it's mentioned alone, it's mentioned in the context with the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And in the last instance, the 14th instance, she's mentioned, her name follows Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Mary's sister, Mary, the mother of Jesus' sister, and then Mary Magdalene is the one that's mentioned third. There's a four-line poem that I'd like to read to you from an unnamed poet, and I don't know if that's Herbert Lockyer writing this or if he's actually, you know, citing it from an unnamed poet. But I think, you know, knowing what we do about the conduct of the disciples and of Peter and of the events that we read about it, preparation for Passover and at the Passover from John 13 to 18, I hope that this will resonate with you a little bit. And this is from an unnamed poet, just 4 lines. Not she with traitorous kiss her master stung. Not she denied him with unfaithful tongue. She, when apostles fled, could dangers brave, last at the cross and earliest at the grave. Mary of Magdala was honored to be the first witness of the resurrection. And let's read about that in John 20. Read about that in John chapter 20. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene, Mary of Magdala, went to the tomb early while it's still dark, saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Then she ran, came to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, "They've taken away the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've laid him." What is fascinating to me is where were the 11? Why weren't they there? What were they doing? I mean, were they incapacitated by the events that they had witnessed and been a part of? But they're not on the scene. You know, and I think Jesus Christ could just as easily have said, "Hey, I want you guys to be here and specify the time and announce it. I'm going to be resurrected. I want you to be the first ones to see it. I want you to be the first to witness that I am raised from the dead and that is going to prove conclusively to you all of the things that I've taught you." But for whatever reason, that wasn't done. First person on the scene is Mary of Magdala. So she goes, gets Simon Peter. Simon Peter and John, you know, run back to the tomb. John's, you know, a little faster or younger and faster, so he gets there first, but he waits. Simon Peter, in his fashion, you know, just keeps right on coming. You know, he goes into the tomb, looks in there, sees the linen clothes lying. Well, that's verse 5, speaking of John. Then in verse 6, Simon Peter came, went into the tomb, saw the linen cloths laying there and the handkerchief that had been around the head, sees all the grave clothes and things like that, and continuing on down. And then in verse 10, then the disciples went away again to their own homes. What are they doing? What are they doing? What are they thinking? Obviously, they didn't get it yet, or at least the... it doesn't appear to me in the context that they weren't there to start with. And then Mary of Magdala basically is the one that's communicating that Jesus Christ is not in the tomb. You know, and you know, she doesn't fully, I don't think she fully comprehends it either, but she's there. You know, she sees it. She's the witness to it. Let's continue in 11. But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. She sees two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. And then they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." What I find interesting about this, Jesus Christ is right in that vicinity. We're gonna read that here in just a second. Jesus Christ could have just as easily said, "Hey, Simon and John, I'm right here." But he chose not to do that. Why, I don't know, but that's from the context here. I think it's obvious he was already right there. Now then, let's continue in verse 14. Now when she said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I'll take him away. You know, I'm going to do the burial preparation." Verse 16, Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned to him and said, "Rabboni," which is to say, teacher. And then he goes on to say in 17 that, you know, don't cling to me, or don't, you know, King James says, "Don't touch me. You have not yet ascended to the Father." We'll read this in the New King James. "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Verse 18, Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things to her. Now, I'm left with the conclusion that Jesus Christ absolutely chose consciously not to show himself to Simon or John first, and that he chose to reveal himself first to Mary of Magdala. A couple verses at the end of Matthew that I'd like to read, getting close to conclusion here. Matthew 27, let's start in verse 55. Make the point again. "And many women who followed Jesus from Galilee ministering to him were there looking on from afar." That's at the crucifixion. not just an all-male event. You know, the women were very much a part of this as well. 56, among them whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joses, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. Now, the mother of Zebedee's sons is a lady named, name slipped my mind. I was going to do that extemporaneously, and I'll probably think about it when I sit down. But you see, we've got at least two Marys, and that's not all the Marys that are mentioned. Okay, so we have 50. Let's go down to verse 61. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the tomb. Don't know if this Mary is either one of the other two that were mentioned prior to that. Scofield Reference Bible has an order of appearance that is just his opinion as a scholar. It's certainly not a doctrinal issue, but I'd like to share that with you in terms of the conclusions that reference material draws as to the order and to the people to whom Jesus Christ revealed himself first at his resurrection. This first, it was Mary of Magdala, which we just read. And secondly, to the women who were returning from the tomb. And there were more than just Mary in terms of the women that were going to the tomb, but she was there first. But Jesus Christ revealed himself first to Mary, then he revealed himself to the group of women that apparently weren't far behind her. And then apparently on that Sunday afternoon sometime, he revealed himself to Peter. And there's a reference in Luke 24:34 where that it says, you know, Simon has already seen the Lord. Simon's already seen the Lord. And it's talking about the context of the disciples that were there. Conclusion, we've seen the very special relationship that Jesus Christ had with these three women, the two sisters, Mary and Martha, or Martha and Mary of Bethany, and with Mary of Magdala. I want to conclude with a couple of verses from Acts 1, as we are a week and a day from Pentecost. I think there's an interesting statement there that connects some of these events to the foundation of the New Testament church. Acts 1, verses 13 and 14. And you know, this is the section here where we start reading in 13. And when they had entered, they went up into an upper room where they were staying. And it lists the 11 remaining disciples who were to become apostles. And 14, these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication. I don't know how many times I've read that, and that's mentally where I stop. But let's read the rest of it. With the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. I think the context is there were a lot of women involved in this at this point. They were waiting too. The 11 disciples are mentioned by name. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned by name. His brothers, I believe, is physical brothers. Because I think that the context to me indicates he's not talking spiritually. At least I don't believe he is. But that's just my opinion. But I think it's the physical brethren of Jesus Christ in addition to his mother and the women. So to me, it's inconceivable to think that Mary, Martha, and Mary of Magdala were not there. Possible that they weren't. But I personally believe very strongly that those three women were there. I think that as we celebrate the Pentecost and as we commemorate, you know, the foundation of the New Testament church here in a week and a day, that we can look at the very special relationship that Jesus Christ had with these very special ladies.